turned this off. Yeah. So my wife gave me the key.
Welcome to your views. If you see me nodding or snoring, bump the hair down the side.
Okay. I got a good elbow.
So that you do.
I knew we were coming back on Sunday.
In Europe Day, we were in recession. We're done.
It's past May.
Yeah, are you, but when are you taking off for
so the battlefield?
Our son has?
Yeah,
pretty
sure.
You got any coffee?
Morning. He went upstairs. I
didn't know that's what you're up there for. You're
in the first time.
The plans are still in flux, but
she had named on phone names.
I'll tell you.
It's not that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, plenty.
Good morning. Thank you for coming back for the continuation of our series, Jesus Means Freedom. The last couple of weeks, from my point of view, have just been wonderful. There were a couple of moments last week that are among the best that I've ever had in an adult education class in all the years that I've been doing this. So my gratitude to you all is just off the charts. Well, as you know, Paul said to the Galatians, "For freedom, Christ has set us free. So don't go back into bondage, back into the things that make us complacent and complicit." And so during this series, we are reminding ourselves that the God of the Bible is the one who called a people out of bondage in Egypt, and who still calls us today out of the constraints that limit the full humanity that God intended in creation. So our series is exploring the liberating dimensions of Jesus' activity. His proclamation of release to the captives, the healing miracles that set people free from disease and from demons, and then Jesus' liberation of the temple, the institutions of society. And finally, we will look at the resurrection stories because they preach freedom from fear. Now today, we turn to two stories from the Gospel of Mark, the first Gospel. Two stories about women. An older woman who has been suffering from an issue, a hemorrhage, a flow of blood for 12 years. And a little girl who is 12 years old and at the point of death. There is a Canadian New Testament scholar named John Miller. He wrote a wonderful book called Jesus at 30, which is a psychological study. Not goofy at all. Well-grounded exegetically. Before he became a New Testament scholar, he was the president of the Psychological Association in Canada. And then he went back to school, became a scholar of the New Testament, and for years he was the chairman of the historical Jesus section at the Society of Biblical Literature. Now, in the last chapter of his book, Jesus at 30, John Miller explores the phenomenon of Jesus's attractiveness to women. In the Gospels, Jesus has female followers, right? Mary Magdalene and many others. And what John Miller noticed was that this is not true of other rabbis in the first century. It's one of the distinctive things about Jesus. And so in the last chapter of his book, he begins to ask himself, why? What was it about Jesus' way of relating to people that made him attractive to groups of women? Yes?
Wouldn't it be considered somewhat scandalous at that time for women to leave hearts and homes, so for any woman to follow him was like really raising eyebrows?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that he has women following him around, supporting him, part of his movement, that would have been very unusual. And the fact that they had left their domestic duties in order to do this, that made it even more scandalous. Yes, Joan.
I was going to say, Jesus didn't do mansplaining.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. I think you're already on to it. Now, we are coming to these two stories and to the remarkable discovery that Jesus meant freedom for women. We're coming to that in the context of a lot of soul searching and conflict between the genders today. Last Saturday, not yesterday, but a week before, a man in his 40s entered a yoga studio in Tallahassee, Florida, and did what? Killed two women and wounded five other people. He killed a 21-year-old girl who was a student at Florida State University. He killed a 62-year-old female doctor who was highly respected and valued in the community. And Joan, in trying to understand this horrible thing, I learned another new word, a word that I'm sorry I know. It's the word incel. What does this refer to?
Involuntarily celibate.
Right.
It's a pathetic internet community of guys who think they are owed sex by women.
That's exactly right. It is, I had no idea this existed. It is an online internet community of men who are angry because they don't get the sex they think they are entitled to. And this man who killed two wonderful women in a yoga studio had been arrested twice before he broke into the studio for what? Groping, right. Sexual imposition. He had been arrested twice.
That word will probably be in the dictionary next year.
I think it will. Right. Involuntarily celibate.
And he's not the first. There was an attack in Canada, I think, a year ago.
That's right. That's exactly right. So it's in that context. It's in the context of hostility now toward women and the Me Too movement that we are looking at these two amazing stories of Jesus and women. Now, scholars puzzle over the connectedness of these two stories. As you probably remember, Jesus is summoned by Jairus to a house where the 12-year-old girl lies at the point of death. And as he is on his way to the house, what happens?
She dies.
But before he gets there, an older woman comes up, you're exactly right, behind him and touches his garment. So, in the Gospel of Mark, these two stories are connected. They're linked. And scholars wonder, were they already linked before Mark wrote his Gospel? Did these stories come down through the oral tradition, already connected? One of my Australian students, you know, I mentor a group of Australian PhD students at Macquarie University, and one of my best students is a lady named Louise Gospel. Her dissertation was just published by T&T Clark Bloomsbury, and it's on disability narratives in the Gospels. I have the honor and the joy of doing a book launch for her book in Denver next week at the annual meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature. I'll get to hold up her book and say some things about it. Now, one of the best chapters in her book is devoted to these two stories. And she argues that they were already linked in the tradition before Mark. She observes that the older woman has been suffering from a flow of blood for how long?
12 years.
12 years. And this is a gynecological condition. I'll talk more about it in just a minute. It was already well known in antiquity. And the little girl is how old?
12 years old.
She's at puberty. And Louise Gospel, who investigated the medical text, the writings of Hippocrates and Galen, discovered that this little girl is also suffering from a gynecological condition. It's called the wandering womb. It was an idea that ancient people had. I'll talk more about it in just a few minutes. So Louise Gospel argues that these two stories are particularly relevant to the things that made women vulnerable to medical conditions. Okay, let's work our way through the two stories so that I can point out things that are happening in the Greek that you might not see in English. And when Jesus had crossed over, he crossed over the sea in the boat back to the other shore, a large crowd was gathered to him, and he was beside the sea. And a certain synagogue leader came to him, whose name was Jairus. And when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and entreated him earnestly, saying, "My daughter is at the point of death." The Greek expression is eschatos eche. She has the last. She has the very stopping point, the end of life. This language is found in inscriptions from the Greek island of Kos, the home of the famous doctor Hippocrates, where a physician named Anaxippos, quote, "saved many of the citizens when they had fallen into sickness and come to the point of death." Eschatos eche, the very same language that's used in the Gospels. So, Jairus says to Jesus, "Come, and lay your hands on her in order that she may be saved and live. And he went away with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing upon him. The Greek expression is sun ethlibon auton. It means to surround and push, to constrain. You get the picture? He's trying to move through the street, but the crowd is pressing upon him. Now there was a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years. The Greek expression is rousis haematos. You see the word for blood here, hematology, right? Rousis means a flow of blood. In fact, this condition is already mentioned by Aristotle. Aristotle investigated everything. And he even wrote a book called De Animalia, in which he compared the human animal to all the other animals. And Aristotle said, quote, the human female has the most abundant menstrual flow of all animals. But if it has become diseased, this blood is known as a rousis haematos, the same expression used in the Gospels. There was a doctor living in Ephesus in the first century, famous doctor named Soranus, and he practiced medicine in Rome before he came to Ephesus. In the fragments of his writings, he distinguishes between a hemorrhage, which is a sudden and disastrous flow of blood, and the various fluxes and flows, discharges, which are chronic and prolonged. The story continues, and she had suffered much under the doctors, literally, hoopaw, pollen, iatron. She had suffered much under many doctors. And she had spent everything that she had. And they had not benefited her at all. Does that sound familiar? But rather, she had become worse. In other words, at one time this woman had what? Money. And she could afford to consult not just one, but many doctors. There are numerous indictments of the physicians of this time. The first century poet, Martial, listen to this. He says, lately, De Aulus was a doctor. Now, he is an undertaker. What the undertaker now does, the doctor did too, before. Isn't that terrible? Physicians were often perceived as greedy. Here's another quotation from Martial. Dr. Herodes had stolen a drinking cup from a sick patient. And when he was detected, he responded to the patient, why do you need to drink in your condition? There is a Hippocratic manual of medicine called Praecepta, Precepts. And a whole section of that manual counsels doctors not to pursue large fees, but to be more concerned about their reputations. The story goes on. Having heard about Jesus, she came from behind. Opisthen, it says in Greek. So she comes up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. Now, I find it beautiful that the author of this story, in the next verse, gives us the inner soliloquy of this woman. What she was saying to herself. Isn't that wonderful? As she came up behind Jesus. For she was saying, and by the way, the Greek verb there is in the imperfect tense, which means what?
Continually.
Yes, she was repeatedly saying it inside her head, or perhaps just under her breath. She was saying over and over again as she approached Jesus, "If I could touch even his clothes, I shall be saved." Now that's a remarkable statement. What it reveals is the woman's faith, her belief. She does not evidently think that Jesus' conscious desire or decision to heal her is what?
Necessary.
She doesn't think that's a prerequisite, Laurie. You're exactly right. Isn't that amazing? Yes.
Does it say save rather than healed? And is there
thank you, Joan. The Greek verb is the verb sozein. And if you look this verb up in the Greek dictionary, the first meaning is to heal, to make well, to rescue, to promote health, broadly conceived. But this is such a rich verb. In early Christian writings, it takes on a spiritual dimension. This is the word from which we get what? Soteriology. The doctrine of salvation. So it's a big, rich verb that embraces not only physical health, but also spiritual and mental well-being. It's well-being broadly conceived. Thank you. It was a popular belief in the ancient world that physical contact with a charismatic person, a person in whom divine power was at work, could have an impact on you. Plutarch tells a story about the Roman general Sulla, whose touch was able to heal. Josephus, the Jewish author, tells a story about Vespasian, the emperor, who was in Egypt, and his touch healed a person. Yes?
Is this where the European tradition of touching for the king's evil comes from?
Isn't that interesting? I don't know, but it's definitely worth investigating. Readers of the Book of Acts may remember that at one point, Luke tells us that people were bringing cloths and touching them to Paul's body and then taking the cloths where? To the homes of the sick. So this is a widespread popular belief in the period. But the point, the interesting point, is the woman's faith. She doesn't think that Jesus' decision to heal her is necessary for her to get better.
It's her contrast faith to the synagogue leader who thinks that Jesus needs to come.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's an interesting contrast. The synagogue leader thinks that Jesus has to be there. He has to come and has to touch. And the woman thinks that if she could only reach out to him. The story goes on. Yes?
Maybe you're going to say this, but what's more amazing to me is that Jesus knows what happened.
Thank you. That's it. We're just about to get there. Yes?
There's also the juxtaposition that she's touching him, whereas the rabbi or the synagogue leader is asking him to touch.
To touch her, exactly. Isn't it interesting? The resonances, right? This is real profound artistry here in the telling of these two stories. And immediately, the text says, the source of her blood was dried up. And, listen to this, it says, she knew in her body, that's what it says literally, that she had been healed or saved, delivered from the, look at this, the English translation is torment, but the Greek word is actually mastix. Can you say that with me? Mastix. You know what it means? It means whip. Whip. The scourge. The whip or the scourge. And now we come to your point. And immediately, everything in the Gospel of Mark happens immediately. And immediately, Jesus knew in himself that power had gone out from him. And he turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? Now,
everybody did.
Everyone did, right? And his disciples, his disciples said to him, Master, you see the crowd pressing upon you, and you ask, who touched me? And then the text says, but he kept looking around to see who had done this. Then the woman, afraid and trembling, and knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. Now, commentators speculate on the reason for her what? Fear and trembling. The older commentaries say that this woman was worried about purity. She has a flow of what?
Blood.
And contact with a menstruating woman makes a person unclean. In fact, even today, in Orthodox churches, Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox, women who are in their menstrual period cannot what? Go inside the church. Right. They have to stand outside the door on Sunday morning. We had a Greek Orthodox woman, a scholar, who came to Fordham recently and made a very dramatic presentation on the situation facing Orthodox women because of that understanding of purity.
But this woman was obviously working her way through the crowd.
Yes.
So a lot of people would have been touching her.
Thank you. In fact, I'm glad you noticed that. In fact, the text of Mark says nothing about purity. And Jesus doesn't seem to be worried about it, does he? Jesus is portrayed as totally indifferent to the question of impurity. So I don't think that is why the woman is trembling and afraid. I think it's because she has what? Taken the initiative. She hasn't waited on Jesus to do what? Decide to heal her. She has dared to what? Access God's power. She has bravely, faithfully crossed a boundary. It's a transgressive thing that she has done in her search for wellness. And then he said to her, daughter, that's another interesting connection between the two stories, isn't it? Daughter, now listen to what he says. Daughter, do you know?
Your
faith. The Greek word your is pulled forward in the sentence. Your faith. Not Jesus' faith, but what?
Your faith.
The woman's faith has
saved you, healed you. Go in peace and be healthy. The Greek word there is literally be freed. Freed from your mastix, which means what? Whip. You've been freed from the whip. The Greek text is clear. It is the woman's faith that has freed her. It is the woman's faith that has saved her. We'll come back to that. While he was still speaking, some people from the household of the synagogue president came saying, "Your daughter has what?
Died.
Why do you still trouble the teacher?" But Jesus overheard the message as it was spoken, and he said to the synagogue ruler, "Me fabu, do not fear. Monon pistue, only believe." Now, the two things that Jesus tells the man are important. First, a word of consolation. Stop fearing. Don't be afraid. And then he says, only believe. Now, in Greek, this is a present imperative, which implies what? Keep on doing it. In Greek, the present tense is the tense of continuous action, ongoing. Don't stop. In other words, persevere in your faith. Believe even in the face of what?
Death.
Exactly. Even in the face of death. And the text says, and he did not allow anyone to accompany him except for Peter, James, and John. And they went into the house of the synagogue president, and he saw a phorubos. Tumult. A tumult of grief. He saw a phorubos, and people were weeping and wailing loudly. The Greek participles here are onomonopoetic. It sounds like what it is. Listen. Kleiontes. That's crying. Kai alalazontes. Alalazontes. Right? That's the sound of wailing. Alalazontes. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you distressed and weeping? The child has not died, but is what?
Sleeping.
Now, scholars wonder whether some ambiguity has been introduced into the story at this point. Is she really what?
Dead.
Or could she be just sleeping? I don't think there's any ambiguity here. I don't see that. The people in the house, they know that she's dead. There's no indication of ambiguity. And I think that's important because the fact that Jesus keeps going, his assertion that she will be saved, even in the face of what? Death. Is an indication of Jesus's faith. Do you see what's happening here? The faith of that old woman who took action and was saved, her faith has now migrated where? Into Jesus. I just think it is so beautiful. Jesus knows that she is dead, but he can't accept it. And to me, in Mark's portrait of the psychology, the spirituality of Jesus, this is a beautiful moment. The little girl is dead, but he what? He can't accept it. He can't accept it. And because he now has the woman's faith in him, he goes on.
And look what the next verse says.
Professor.
Yes.
This is another deal with Jesus where you think he's being a little arrogant or a little flippy. In other words, he says to those people, why are you weeping? Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't have approached those people that way. You know.
Do you know what I think? I think one of the aspects of the Gospel of Mark that needs to be explored more fully, Mark presents us with a Jesus who doesn't have it all figured out. He's growing and developing. Mark's Jesus is emotional. The first healing that Jesus performs in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 1, Jesus is on his way down the road, and a leper comes and falls down before him, and the leper says to Jesus, you remember, he says, if you will it, if you, Jesus, wish, you can make me clean. And then Mark says, he felt a wrenching in his guts. You see, he doesn't have it all together. He's not super confident. He feels a wrenching in his guts. And he says, I will it. Well, we could talk a lot more about this, but if I live long enough, I'm going to write a little book on Mark's portrait of Jesus. How much Mark portrays Jesus as feeling strong emotions and learning from his encounters with people. Jesus himself is great. At first, he tells people not to reveal to anyone that he is what? The Messiah, the Christ. But at the end of the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus is put on trial before the Sanhedrin, and the high priest confronts him directly and says to him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus, in Mark's Gospel, finally says what?
If you
say, I am. No, that's Matthew and Luke. In Matthew and Luke, they equivocate. In Matthew and Luke, Jesus says, you say that I am. Or that's what you say. But Mark's Jesus says, I am. And you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. There are many other moments of profound struggle. In the Garden of Gethsemane, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is grieving and is at pain to the point of death. He prays that he will not have to what? Die. And when Jesus is hanging on the cross in the Gospel of Mark, in Mark he says only one thing. No. In Mark he cries out in the midst of the darkness, my God, why have you forsaken me? Mark's Jesus is, he doesn't have it all figured out. He's developing and growing. But look at the next verse.
Real quick, I've read that the Gospel of Mark is considered, was supposedly written to four new disciples to give them instruction and encouragement. Apparently, so that if they're working through their faith, they see Jesus doing the same thing. Is that what's happening here?
I think you're right. The best hypothesis, I think, is that the Gospel of Mark was written to Christians in Rome. That's what Clement of Alexandria says. Poor people who are living on the wrong side of the Tiber River in Rome, who have just experienced the first state-sponsored persecution of the followers of Jesus. By whom? That sociopath Nero, who blamed the Christians for the Great Fire. So I think you're right. I think Mark is trying to say to those Christians on the wrong side of the Tiber River, Jesus himself suffered, struggled. Jesus himself came to a deeper understanding of his calling.
and his faithfulness. The text says, and they began to laugh mockingly at him. The crowd mocks Jesus. They laugh at him. But he drove them all out, and he took the father of the child and the mother and those with him and went into the room where the child was. And he grasped the hand, this is so beautiful, of the child and said to her, Talitha kumi. Now that's not Greek, it's what?
Hebrew.
Aramaic, yes. It is the language that Jesus learned at his mother's knee. It is the intimate language of the family. Talitha kumi. And Mark has to translate it for his Greek readers, which means, little girl, I say to you, wake up. And immediately the girl arose and began to walk. And now we find out she was 12 years old. And they were immediately in great amazement. And Jesus ordered them strongly that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given to the girl to eat. Now, before we try to draw the lessons, I would like to fill in the background, the context, just a little bit. Because there are other stories that are told about famous doctors who bring people back from what appears to be the dead. So here's a story told about the famous doctor Asclepiades. This story goes back to the time of Tiberius. So it's exactly the time of Jesus. Jesus was crucified under Tiberius. Here's the story. The famous Asclepiades, who ranks among the greatest of doctors, it chanced once when he was returning from his country house that he observed an enormous funeral procession. A huge multitude of people had come out to perform the last honors. And they stood around the bier, all of them plunged in deep sorrow. Asclepiades went near to the bier to see who had died. The poor fellow's limbs were already covered with spices. He was all ready for the pyre. He was going to be burned, yeah, cremated. But Asclepiades looked at him and took note of certain signs and handled his body and perceived that life was still in him, though scarcely to be detected. Asclepiades cried out, "He lives! Throw down your torches. Take the funeral feast back to the man's house." And while he spoke, listen to this, a murmur arose. Some said that they must take the doctor's word, while others mocked him. Now listen to this. And some of the man's relatives offered opposition because they had already entered into possession of the dead man's property. But Asclepiades persuaded them to delay the burial for a time. He carried the man home and revived him by means of certain drugs. Right. Here's the second story, the last one. And this story is told about Apollonius of Tyana, who was a famous holy man who lived in the time of Jesus. A girl seemed to have died just in the hour of her marriage. The bridegroom was following the bier, lamenting, along with a large crowd of mourners.
Apollonius witnessed their grief and said, "Put down the beer, for I will stop your tears that you are shedding for this maiden." Now the crowd assumed that Apollonius was about to deliver a funeral oration. He was going to offer them consolation. But instead, he went to the body of the girl and touched her and whispered into her ear. At once, the girl woke up from her seeming death. She spoke out loud and returned to her father's house. Now, the life of Apollonius is written by a philosopher named Philostratus. And after telling the story, Philostratus comments, quote, "Now, whether Apollonius detected some spark of life in her, which those who were nursing her had not noticed, or whether life really was extinct, and he restored it to her by the warmth of his touch, is a mysterious problem which neither I myself nor those who were present were able to decide." So he ends with a conundrum, right? Now, if we compare these two stories with the story found in Mark about the 12-year-old girl, what's the obvious difference? What do you not hear in these two stories? Faith. Jim, exactly right. If you were in my class at Fordham today, I'd give you an A+. This is the payoff of the comparative approach to the Gospels, right? The payoff is to be able to isolate what is distinctive in the Gospel tradition. And what is distinctive, what is different, is faith. It's not found in the two Greek stories. All right. To me, the lessons from all of this are clear, even if they are a little bit challenging. Maybe they change our picture of Jesus and of his relationship with people. The first...
I think the first question we ask, though, is borne out in this, because Jesus was showing great respect for these women.
Right.
And he had faith in them, just like he had faith in the men.
Thank you. Did you hear that?
No.
Her point is a very good one. One thing that comes through clearly is that Jesus is showing respect for these women. He is not above them, right? He's not indifferent to them. He accepts the invitation to go to the house where a little 12-year-old girl is dying. He tells the woman who has touched him, "Daughter, your what?
Your
faith has saved you." My son Mark. Did you teach Mark?
No.
Okay. My younger son Mark, his favorite story in the Gospel of Mark is at the very end when Jesus is teaching in the temple. People are coming to the temple to make their gifts and benefactions, and men come and they put a lot of money into the treasury box. And a little woman comes, a widow, and she puts in what? Two mites, the two smallest coins. Now, do you know what I think is a presupposition of that story? I don't think anyone else saw that woman that day. But Jesus turns to his disciples and says what? Do you see that woman? She has given more than all of the rest because she put in what? Everything she had. Her whole life. He saw her. Right? He saw her. I don't think anyone else even noticed her that day. Now, the fact that that is Mark's favorite story probably reflects the fact that he didn't get much allowance from his father. But your point is the more profound one, right? He saw the woman with her two mites. When someone touched him, the text of Mark says that even though the disciples ridiculed Jesus for asking, "Who touched me?" The text says he turned around and he what? He kept looking and looking in the crowd until the woman stepped forward. Okay, so I think your point is the first lesson, that it all begins with respect, with taking one another seriously where we find one another. The second point, I think, is also really important and a little bit surprising. I think the two stories together indicate that the woman's faith, the faith of the woman with the flow of blood, made an impact upon whom?
Jesus.
Her faith taught him. It migrated into him. Third lesson. Don't fear. Fear debilitates. Fear stops us. Jesus tells the synagogue president, don't fear. Persevere in faith, even in the face of death. Only believe. Keep on believing. Believe even in the face of mockery, right? The crowd does what? Mocks Jesus. Believe even in the face of mockery. And believe even in the face of death. Jesus knows that the little girl is dead, but that doesn't stop him from believing. And in one of the most touching moments in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus goes into the room, takes the little girl by the hand, and says what? Talitha kumi. Little girl, sit up. I just can't tell you how beautiful I think these stories are. Yes?
I just didn't want you to forget. What was the relationship with the 12-year-old and the female problem?
Yes. So, thank you. Thank you. I almost forgot to talk about that. The doctors, who are all male in the time of Jesus, had a theory about gynecological conditions from which young girls at the point of the onset of puberty suffered. And you can find descriptions of this in the Hippocratic corpus, the corpus of writings that are attributed to the famous doctor Hippocrates. The condition they believed, how primitive medicine was in that period, they believed that a young woman whose onset of menstruation was somehow limited or blocked, who had pain but blood did not flow, was suffering from a wandering womb. So the womb, the doctors explained, the womb was doing what? Wandering around the body. And couldn't, I know, isn't this nutty? But this is mansplaining, right? This is a man assuming that he knows what? What's going on in a woman's body? So it was the theory of the wandering womb. The womb was wandering around the body and couldn't find the proper place from which the menstrual flow should issue. So that's what the little girl is suffering from, according to the male doctors. She's suffering from a wandering womb.
I think,
yes.
So, Larry, the one thing that you have to really remember is that any great teacher has great expectations. And Jesus had expectations,
yes,
for each person.
Right.
What did she say?
Any great teacher has great expectations. And Jesus has expectations
for each one,
for each person who
for all of us
comes to him. Joan?
The problem I have, I guess, with your faith has healed you is that it implies that if you don't get healed, you don't have enough faith. How do you respond to that?
Thank you. Thank you. I think you have really identified a potential problem with the message that Mark is putting out here. I could respond by saying that this passage and all of the stories that portray Jesus liberating people from disease or demons because of faith, this passage needs to be put alongside of a moment, a very important moment, in one of Paul's letters. In 2 Corinthians, Paul's critics at Corinth had challenged Paul to demonstrate that he had the signs of an apostle, that he was a legitimate spiritual leader. And they challenged Paul to tell about a healing that he had performed, right? And Paul says, okay, you want to hear about that? He says, three times I asked God in prayer to remove what? My thorn in the flesh. Paul had some sort of physical infirmity. He never says what it was. He calls it his thorn in the flesh. Three times, Paul says, I asked God to remove my thorn in the flesh, and God said what? No. My grace, it's one of the most profound and beautiful moments in Paul. God said to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you as you are. My strength is perfected in your what?
Weakness.
And so Paul says, and so then I'm content with weakness. For when I'm weak, then God is strong. And Paul goes on to observe that Jesus himself was crucified in weakness, but he lives by the power of God. In that moment, Paul breaks through our common assumptions that if we only believe enough, right, if we're only persistent enough in prayer, we will be what? Healed. And Paul breaks through to a deeper and more paradoxical understanding of existence. God's power is perfected even in our weakness. Yes?
Now you mentioned earlier, too, that there's a connection between the illness of what they thought was the illness of a little girl and the woman's illness.
Yes.
What was that?
Right. They are both suffering from what? They're both suffering from bad doctors, but they're both suffering from gynecological conditions that affect their ability to produce, to reproduce, and so forth. So whoever put these stories together, I think, has chosen deliberately two women from opposite stages of life. Young girl entering puberty and a woman at the stage in her life when the flow of blood should have ceased. Right. Now, Joan, I could also answer your very good question autobiographically with a story from my own life that illustrates my own struggle to go on believing. Can I tell you that story?
Sure.
It's a little bit embarrassing.
No.
When Diane and I were students at the University of Chicago, and Pastor Bossy, just after I had started teaching at your alma mater, McCormick Theological Seminary, Diane developed a condition called endometriosis. And even the doctors at the University of Chicago Hospital failed to diagnose it. They said, oh, it's your appendix is about to rupture, or maybe you have an infection. And because they couldn't diagnose it, guess what happened? It ruptured. We had a medical emergency. She had to be rushed to the hospital. And the next morning after surgery, the doctor came and visited with Diane and I and said to us, well, you probably won't have any children. But he said, if you want to have children, you need to get started trying right away. I went out of the hospital to get our little car so that I could bring Diane home. I have to confess to you, Joan, that up to that point in my life, I had never felt such blackness in my heart, such fear and anger over the hand that life had dealt me, the idea that we would not have children at all. And I was walking along the sidewalk on the way back to our apartment, passing beside Regenstein Library. It was May, the end of the semester. And I was walking along that sidewalk just angry at God and disappointed with life. And at some point, I looked up and I noticed that it was a beautiful day. That the sun was shining and the birds were singing, flowers were blooming, that life was going on. And Joan, it was strange, you know, somewhere down inside me, the anger and bitterness melted away, and I resolved to go on, whatever might come. Maybe you've had experiences like that, right? Would I call that moment my Regenstein epiphany? Would I call that moment faith? I don't know, maybe. All I know is life in God's beautiful world delivered me, saved me from my despair and anger. And I resolved to go on. Keep on believing, Jesus tells the synagogue ruler, right? Yep. Don't fear. Keep on believing. Yes?
So, is there an episode, I think I know the answer to the question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there an episode in any of the Gospels where Jesus refuses to heal? Or even questions to determine worthiness?
That is a very good question. There's only one that I know of. The disciples who have been sent out by Jesus to continue his work and mission, they come back to Jesus and they report on the success that they have had, but they also report on some failures. And with regard to the exorcism of demons, Jesus tells the disciples there are some demons that only come out through prayer and fasting. There's another healing story in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verses 22 to 26. A blind man, born blind, finds out that Jesus is coming through town, and he cries out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus takes the man aside, and he bends down and makes little mud pies and puts them on the man's eyes and says, go wash and you'll see. And the man goes and washes and comes back and he says, well, I see colors and lights. I see men walking around, but they look like trees. And what does Jesus do? He repeats the mud pie treatment. He bends down and puts some more mud on the man's eyes and tells him to go wash again. So there are little moments like that where the Gospels acknowledge that healing is not instantaneous.
Right.
That exorcism and healing requires more.
But he never said not you.
He never said not you. That's exactly right. He never said not you. Well, thank you all so much for engaging everything so faithfully today, for all the comments and questions. Now, I need to share with you all something that Joan and I have been negotiating. Next Sunday, I will be in Denver, Colorado, at the annual meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature. So there will be no class next Sunday. And the Sunday after that, I will be somewhere above the ground, flying back on the red eye from California to Cincinnati, but arriving too late to be here for class. So we will have a hiatus. You could think of it as reading week or a fall break. We'll have two Sundays without a class, but the class will then be extended into December. So the first two Sundays of December, we will continue our class. And it's possible we may even be able to go down to the third Sunday in December if I don't have to help my son move to the United Kingdom.
As a consolation prize, we are going to do the last two sessions in the half-truths in the Bible, or half-truths that are not in the Bible, the DVD series, so next week in the 18th and the 25th.
Oh, wow, so, that's great. Yeah. Sorry I have to miss that.
Video series.
Thank you very much.
Next week.
I did a long time ago. When I was